actually a very important topic. It's about taxes, and it's important because it's currently, I think many agree, it's difficult to understand taxes, except for that in the end, lots of cash flows drain or are paid, or the company are end up being paid as tax. So this is actually a big topic, even though it's just a single line somewhere very low down in the results and the financial position. We had two pieces, and I found the two pieces to be quite difficult to digest, to be honest. So I hope that Mitsuhiro and Grace will enlighten us on this important topic. And I'd like to make sure that before the CMEC ends up providing an advice, that we make sure that we feel on top of the topic before that we actually send out our clear preferences. So with that challenge ahead, I can give you the word, Mitsuhiro.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much, CMEC members, for taking time to this research project on income tax. My name is Mitsuhiro. She is Grace. She's mainly speaking today, but I would like to say a few words before she's going to present. First of all, I'd like to say thank you very much for some CMEC members who talked to us and advised us in preparation for this meeting. I also want to say thanks for many CMEC members who completed survey and submitted to us before the meeting. I think your input was very valuable and gave us great insight about direction on income tax project. Before passing to Grace, I'd like to explain background about income tax, why we are doing this. There are many criticisms about current tax information in financial statements. Some academics say deferred tax is not relevant, people are not really using. Some preparers say current IAS 12 produce some accounting results that is funny, doesn't make sense from a clinical viewpoint. But there are various views about current accounting standard for income tax, but that view is not really uniform. They are diverse, but it's quite difficult to understand where the focus area is. So we decided to talk to users first to identify the focus area. So the survey we kindly asked and you kindly completed before meeting was helpful to see where the focus area is. Before passing to Grace, I would like to say one more thing about time management. We have three questions today. We have two papers, Agenda Paper 3 and Agenda Paper 3A. In Agenda Paper 3, in page 8, there's a question 1. And page 10, we have question 2. Page 12, we have question 3. So because we have three questions, we can maybe use about average 20 minutes or so, but we can adjust depending on your interest. And also, as Chair mentioned, paper 3A is complex, so I prepared summary slides. I think that our staff will distribute those summary slides. Barbara, have you?
Yes, so in the pack after the case study, there's a printout of two. This wasn't sent to you originally, but there's a printout.
So I try to explain this complex issue using two slides. So hopefully, I will be successful in explaining it. But before going to this complex issue, we would like to start from maybe easier one. So I will pass it to Grace for presentation.
Great. Maybe let's start from page 3, and it's about the objective of today's session. the ultimate question is, we want to know whether you think the current standard should be amended by replacing it by a new standard, or it should be just a narrow scope amendment. To achieve, before we jump into the conclusion about this, we would like to know more about how exactly is tax information being used by investors nowadays, and we would also like to know your general perception towards today's accounting for income taxes. And all your comments will help us to decide our further actions for this research project. And on slide 5, it is the objective of the current standard for income taxes, which is stipulated as to provide information about current tax, which is the tax payable or refundable for the current period, as well as deferred tax, which is the future tax consequence of the differences of assets and liabilities between the tax return and financial statements, which is also known as the temporary difference approach. And as a result of the approach, the tax effects of all timing difference, as well as other difference like distributed profits in subsidiaries, will be recognized as deferred tax in the balance sheet, and the change in deferred tax will be recognized in the profit and loss statement. So on slide 6 is about why we are doing this project, and which is introduced by Mr. Hiro just now. And it is because we have received a lot of criticisms over these years about many of our stakeholders are doubtful about the usefulness of the information provided, and they doubt that the objective of the standard is not achieved. Preparers also think that the information, the accounting for income tax is very complex and it's very costly and timely to prepare information while investors are not actually using them. And standard setters like the IFRS in 2011, they have published a discussion paper discussing about possible improvements to be made to the standard. But they decided in 2012 that they are not working further on this on the project. But they suggest any further actions is to be extracting from users. Okay. So we have taken advice and start by sending you a user survey in January, and in the survey we try to understand what specific tax information is used and how this information is linked to the valuation techniques you apply. And the results is summarized in slide 20 and 21. Well, we learned that most frequently used valuation techniques are discounted cash flow and multiples, and some of you also use analyzed capital structures. And when applying this valuation technique, you mentioned that you will make use of the unrecognized deferred tax assets to adjust profit and loss, and you will also adjust the effective tax rates by removing some non-recurring items. And our first question is that, do you think the result is a fair reflection of your current practice? And can you share more about details on how other qualitative and quantitative tax information is incorporated into your analysis?
So that's the question on slides.
Slide 8.
Okay. So the question is, how do you use tax information today?
Yes.
I think there are many members that can comment on that because we all have to. How do you use tax information today? Is everybody ashamed about how simple we mean? I don't know. Okay, we have Peter and Carlos.
Marietta.
No. Nowhere to
So I think the big issue that I have is really, I mean, our main job is obviously forecasting as analysts. And What I really need to know is not so much how I wind the deferred tax asset through my future forecast, but actually, if my assumptions about the business are correct, about the future geographic mix, about the future mix of, you know, drugs coming from different jurisdictions with patent boxes and so forth, how would that actually influence the tax rate over time? So this is kind of mix effect analysis, which I also do on an operating level. And on an operating level, it's quite easy for me because I do actually know, just from years of analysis, what the margin structure of the various business activities are, so I can automatically calculate the mix effect. And with the tax rate, the actual tax rate I get given by the company for the year that's just ended, it's just a black box number. It can be 23%, and I'm like, well, why is it not 20%? Why is it not 26%? And the best I can do is ask the company whether it's going to change anytime soon, and they'll probably say no. And you know, you just basically extrapolate it for but actually, you know, I think there is an element of, you have very different tax rates all over the world, you have very international businesses with mixes changing. So, you know, if you have suddenly a lot more exposure to the US and emerging markets, which have higher tax rate, that can drive up the tax rate, but that's somewhat mitigated through other structures like patent boxes and all sorts of, you know, flows through subsidiaries and whatever that drive it down. And some of that is actually now being questioned by, you know, by the lawmakers and by the tax authorities. So it would be really helpful to actually have an understanding of today's tax rate, you know, what sort of the overall tax rate is from mix effects, and then what tax credits were taken against them and how you got to that, because then you could really make your own assumptions about going forward.
Good. Peter.
I have a similar comment as Marietta. To me, the tax area is divided into two parts. One is 1 year, or rather one quarter ahead. And I want a tax rate to assess on my estimate. And hopefully I can look at the historical pattern and find the tax rate that way. If I can't, I will ask the company what presumably will be your tax rate going forward this year, 2015, because it's actually about how I estimate and how others estimate. And hopefully we all will use roughly the same figure. So the taxes will not deviate that much because it, as Marietta pointed out, it's a very difficult figure for us to estimate or have an opinion on. We need to rely on the figures that the company presents. So on a yearly basis, I need a figure, hopefully a stable figure, the same kind of figure that everybody else is using. Longer term, I'm becoming more and more interested in cash taxes. Because the current debate, Ireland, Luxembourg, and Cayman Islands, and everything, money is flowing through the system, and I'm using a 24% tax rate, I'm starting to wonder whether I should use like 3% or so. It seems to me like at least the Swedish companies don't pay any tax, at least not the international companies. And that's, probably I should keep quiet. So that is my major concern. Long term, I need some more oriented cash tax rate because I do these DCF valuations, and since I'm oriented toward cash, I think cash tax rates are the tax rate that I need to apply. Then in Sweden, the third item is the following. We are a very prudent country. Because we don't like deferred tax assets. That is imprudent to calculate for deferred tax assets. Meaning that if you are prudent in 1 year, you are imprudent in the following year. So consequently, when a company in Sweden has a loss 1 year, the tax rates the following 2 years or 3 years will be unsustainably low because they don't calculate deferred tax assets. And that's a major problem in Sweden. And the auditors that I talk to, they point at the ISB, say that, that it must be possible to use within a short time frame, probably 3 years. And we cannot really be sure of that. So we want to have a prudent approach on this. We don't want to overstate the assets. And consequently, they understate the tax cost in the following income statements. And that's, but I probably, maybe that's a general problem, but it's a very Swedish problem that I come across all the time.
Okay, thank you. Carlos?
Usually I look at basically three things. One, it's obvious, the actual tax rate in the P&L. And then most companies would talk about what's the effective tax rate, and then, you know, the cash tax rate. So, you know, what I would like to see is some reconciliation between the three. You can have an idea around where are the benefits and the costs. And
obviously, that's a dumb question. What is a cash tax rate? Is that the actual check you have to write out?
Yes. And obviously, you have, you know, the difference between the effective and the cash tax rate may be many, but it's timing differences and the use of credit or payments of liability.
And you still have tax incentives that would make it even more confusing.
Okay, well, one of the questions, how do you use at the moment the information? It's, for me as an analyst, it's very difficult. What I do is the tax assets, I assume they are NOLs, and net operating losses carry forward. And I try to work that out, how that would affect in making, because NOLs are usually not company-wide available, but only to a limited part of the company. You say maybe 25% of the company profit can be, and those are all kinds of assumptions, how effective those NOLs are. Try to assess when that, for how many years that spread out could result in lower cash taxes. And on the liabilities, I assume they will reverse to nil. And I make an assumption on how long it takes for those liabilities to go to nil. Usually it takes a long time because maybe the company is still growing. But those all are very vague, over-the-thumb assumptions that do affect valuation. And if I observe a company having like an 8% tax rate, I really question whether that's sustainable. Usually the marginal tax rate of the company is just the corporate tax rate of the country, usually. So that's 30%. So one of my basic assumptions is that it will revert to the marginal tax rate in the long run of the country, unless I really have evidence. For example, with Dutch company ASML, they say, because we invested in knowledge, patents, and those are investments, the fruits of those investments are, because of the nature of our technology investment, exempted from tax forever. So then I have such clear evidence that there will be, on that part of the business, there will be no taxes ever, unless the government changes minds. Then I have a clear, maybe I lower it to whatever then the company is. But so it's a very complex, currently it's very complex, and full of over-the-thumb assumptions to get somewhere. And that's, I think it's bad, it's a shame to create risk.
I think we need to be a little bit clear about what information it's possible to give and what information we should give to users of financial statements in terms of tax. So that in general, we tend to think of tax as a kind of partnership share in the profits of the enterprise. But we account for it like it's a creditor. And that's part of the problem. So we're assuming, I think wrongly, that we need to find it's not a partnership share, because of course the basis on which the tax authority is calculating its share is on a completely different set of numbers from the ones that you see in the financial statements. So that mismatch is what creates that tension. That's why I think, personally, it's impossible to get an effective tax rate, because what you're trying to do is to get the mismatch between the tax statements and the financial statements, and because they're not on the same basis, there's never going to be a match. I think the consequence of that is we've ended up with these rather awkward concepts of deferred tax assets, deferred tax liabilities, and deferred. I think, personally, they're not helpful. And they're not helpful. To me, they're not helpful. They're not helpful to me because they're doing something that I think financial statements probably shouldn't do, which is they're trying to smooth out what is effectively volatility. And volatility is a really important concept for investors to face and to understand, because the more volatile the business, the higher its cost of equity. If you hide that by smoothing it, in this case the tax rate, you're hiding some of the volatility, and you're giving a misleading signal, in my opinion, to the market about the real risk that business faces. So my view on this is, I would much rather the company just told us what they paid in that particular year, and if there were going to be any changes in the future, and then we're faced with the same volatility that the company itself faces, because it isn't true that the tax rate is going to be just because you made a loss this year, you're going to have a higher tax rate next year. It depends on what your profits are and what you're going to do. And we never account for profits on the basis that, you know, that they're deferred tax, they're deferred assets. We don't say, oh, well, we're going to make a profit next year, because we haven't a clue, right? We have a presumption, but we don't have a contractual right to make anything. So we don't have a contractual obligation to pay taxes, but we know that if we make profits, we may, in some circumstances, have to pay taxes. So I think I'd much rather see the whole volatility in the tax issue come out. It's not, and my point is that although it's framed as a profit share, because the way it's calculated, it actually turns out to be like more like a preferred or a creditor. Like there are some contractual elements to it that we need to recognise in the financial statements.
You're questioning the whole objective of the current tax accounting.
Yes. I think in my answer, basically, I gave a very, very simple answer saying that I think it's hard to use, basically. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask one question? If we don't account for the deferred tax, would you still want to see similar information in note?
Mm-hmm. I'd much rather they told us that because they made a loss this year and they would expect to recover that loss next year, and they tell us what the loss is, then you can make your own judgment about whether they can recover the loss or not, right? Because otherwise, you know, I spend my life with financial institutions. They have made so many losses in the last 4 or 5 years that basically you'd assume that these were the most magnificently profitable businesses in the future because they have deferred tax assets that are bigger than their balance sheets right now in some cases.
Okay, your opinion contrasts a bit with Peter's observation, because Peter observes that that he faces trouble with basically Sweden is the country for you to invest in. Thank you, Robert.
So today I look at very much the rate, and when I'm talking rate or amount, cash taxes are particularly important because that's what they're paying right now. So I do look at that. I look at deferred taxes because it's a flag for reversals. What you're interested in the capital-intensive businesses is they're always growing, they keep piling up. They're depreciating faster than on tax for accounting. And in theory, there will be a reversal when their depreciation pools are chewed up and they really start paying a much higher effective rate. I've always asked, what is the right tax rate to use? Because I marvel at, you know, you're saying, you know, in what jurisdiction you can sort of figure it out. I've never been lucky enough. There are a bunch of things that are polluting that theoretical number. I've never seen anybody use the long-term rate. So you need to ask them. And then there is a final sort of comment. So these are information are useful. To Glenn's point, they're weak. I actually have modeled full taxes on project financing, special entities where you have to do it. In the mining sector, in some jurisdictions, you get a 100% depreciation, so you actually have to, from an NPV point of view, model the cash. And from that experience, there is no way you can ever give us enough information on a consolidated basis to be able to do the modeling. It's just, even in a special purpose entity, the tax modeling is a page. It's 50, 60 lines to do it properly on a relatively simple special purpose entity. If I had to model five of them, it gets complicated. If I was doing a pharmaceutical, it would just explode. So I think we're going to have to find shortcuts. One shortcut that might work is maybe companies should disclose their projected tax rate this year for the next 5 years plus a long-term rate, and every year if they change that number, that would be a very interesting discussion.
Have a discussion about it.
Why did you tell us it was going to be this and now it's that? If deferred taxes isn't helping, maybe.
Interesting. This, okay. Sure.
Thank you. Interesting comment I'm hearing. On many people are concerning about the deferred tax assets. You know, maybe I'd like to know whether you prefer a kind of conservatism rather than prudence. Prudence is, we are not asking to not recognize assets. It's not. It seems to me that different people use different meaning of prudence. But conservatism, if you say so, then do not recognize vague assets. So in your case, maybe deferred tax assets is one of the famous, maybe notorious items. Maybe some companies are manipulating some numbers. So basically, this is quite a big issue in our conceptual framework. Maybe last week, if you had a chance to look at the Financial Times, there are some investors and us are having a big debate about this prudence. So, but we are using prudence, but actually that's based on basically on the conservatism. So what is your opinion about your CNEC members about this conservatism? Whether we should keep or introduce the kind of concept rather than neutrality? So basically this is the deferred tax asset, so one good example. Whether we should keep just neutrality or some kind of bias.
I want to shortcut this because I think it's a valid question, but we're not talking about prudence at the moment. We're talking about taxes, and it will be we need to have a paper on something to discuss on. I think we're expanding now beyond the remit of the paper. I understand your question, but we will get carried away big time.
Yeah, I'm saying that deferred tax asset is the most important, maybe famous issue when you talk about this conservative. That's why I'm saying I would like to hear that. I understand.
Yeah,
we can talk later.
Dan, please.
Yeah, so I just wanted to get back to how we use the information. I think the one thing that surprises me here is that the cash taxes paid is the least important, because for me, and I wonder if that's because of the lack of good disclosure, or is it because it's really not that important? Because if you have for companies that have good disclosure, a long-term trend in cash taxes paid to me is the ideal thing to look at. The other big thing I think is that most companies tell you the other big thing I think is so better disclosure on cash taxes paid I think would be great. And then the other thing is better disclosure. The other big thing that impacts taxes these days, which is already brought up, is where are you making your money? And most companies just say domestic tax rate, foreign, and that's all you get. And I think the biggest thing to do is to, and for these companies that just have unsustainably low tax rates, all they say is it's due to earnings in foreign jurisdictions. And to me that's not an adequate answer because I don't understand how dramatically your earnings could have changed from one year to the next such that you're making all this money in a foreign jurisdiction. So those are just the two suggestions that I had. I mean, I personally think using deferred tax assets to try to forecast cash flows is just a waste of time, quite frankly, because first of all, they're backward looking in terms of how you value them. So a lot of auditors, so a lot of times it's a three, if you have 3 years of losses, you have to set up a valuation allowance against your deferred taxes, even if you're expecting to make money next year. I think it's they're fairly arbitrary, and you don't get a good sense of timing unless they're NOLs. So I think cash is preferable, but again, there's not great disclosure around the actual cash taxes paid.
Okay, thank you. We still have Goro, please. Yes.
Yes. I used to be a bank analyst at the latest of the Japanese banking crisis, and this deferred tax asset issue was really serious. You know, it is really complicated. You know that the banks. I think that it might be quite similar that after the Lehman crisis, but since the loss carry forward is so huge, and it is uncertain when that the bank started actually paying the taxes. And in fact, that the Japanese banks were so notorious at not paying taxes for very, very long term. So that this kind of, you know, disclosure is very important, I believe. And in order to calculate some meaningful numbers, that I need to know that the bank's, you know, projection of future income, which is fit justify that the carrying that this huge deferred tax assets, but this might be different country by country. You know, tax regulations should be different country by country for it to be very difficult. But regarding that prudence, just the Chang mentioned, also it might be a relevant, but the deferred tax assets are deducted from that capital from the prudential regulation point of view. It means that the banking regulator regarded to deny that they this is not applicable. So assuming that the banks are surviving as an ongoing concern, that I don't think that this deferred tax asset should not be denied. But still, from that the kind of financial stability point of view, which is very important for the bank's valuation, that this deferred tax asset number is quite important. But still, I admit that it is really difficult to analyze.
Okay. We have to take a look at the time here. We want to make progress. I still have Peter and Marietta. Is there really something you would want to add in this stage?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm the co-chair.
I know, Peter. I have like a 5% chance. Go ahead, Peter.
I have no problems with deferred taxes. I haven't talked about deferred tax liabilities. And I think they are useful, but I want them separated into deferred tax liabilities that are created on revaluations, mainly IAS 40 and 41 biological assets, revaluations. Because to me, they are separate from deferred tax liabilities that, for example, occurs when you have accelerated depreciation, which you can have basically in eternity. So that is very similar to an interest-free equity part on the liability side. So I want the deferred tax liabilities separated into revaluations and the other.
Okay,
so
that's question two.
Okay, sorry.
just a very quick comment. I just also wanted to flag that the quarterly tax rate in the P&L is actually completely meaningless, because basically what the companies tell you is that they make an assumption what their tax rate for the full year is going to be, and then in the quarter that's just ended, they basically assume whatever tax rate is needed to bring the year-to-date average tax rate to what they think the full year tax rate is going to be. So I just think, and given that, shares react to that kind of thing, it's just, this is just a completely random number. Another random number is companies do report a lot of times non-IFRS alternative performance measures, which I think for various reasons is very, very useful for investors. But they never explain to us where the core or the non-IFRS tax rate is coming from. And of course, this is a number that doesn't get reconciled in any shape or form through the balance sheet or P&L because it's really just a restatement of the P&L. So this is basically a number that just comes out of the blue, and people base their valuations and things like that on it in part, but it doesn't have any substance.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. We're seeing the results from the survey and the discussion we have just now. We can see that we have very diversified comments. Maybe due to the different jurisdictions the investors came from, and also the different industries they came from, and the role they played in the capital market. And but from the survey, we heard that every one of them actually use tax information in performing their analysis to a certain extent, but all of them considers that the current disclosure is insufficient, and where you have just said it's unclear and difficult to understand. And only very few of them consider deferred tax balances as in the same way as what it should be as stated in the current standard. As the future income tax is still past transactions or events. So our next question is to you is, do you think the current standard for the, especially regarding deferred taxes, provides useful information to you, or would you prefer for other disclosures? I think this is some discussion we have just now, but if you have any supplement, comments to
them. Well, in general, maybe we highlighted in the previous, in the first part, all kinds of concerns about that.
We have already.
And basically, you mirror that to solve those concerns about what actual cash flows, cash outflows, what's the long term corporate tax rate. Expected. What's the marginal tax rate? If we make a little 1% profit in every operating company, what's the effect on the tax rate? Will it rise or go down? I mean, I think do you really want to go over all our questions? Because what's your question?
This may or may not be a fair question, but I wonder sometimes if people understand what we're trying to achieve with the deferred tax information, because I think there were different responses in the survey as to what deferred taxes mean. I think it's a fair, if you're not clear what we were trying to achieve, it's a portfolio, because that's one of the questions that come up a lot.
I don't know anybody that's confident in understanding deferred tax. And most people kind of ignore it because it's too bloody complicated. So, I mean, either you provide that information but disaggregate it, it's very clear from the papers that it combines, half a dozen different things into one number. And obviously that's going to be meaningless to me. So either you disaggregate it or you move on entirely. Sorry, Rob.
Robert.
I want to take up this, so I will be very clear on two things. First of all, I think it's interesting that we as a group didn't quite get the right answers what deferred taxes are. But I want to echo this comment about no understanding. So I'll be very clear. I have no idea what's in that black box. But that's even more alarming because of my earlier comment of, by the way, I've actually worked on, I could give you a tax number. When you give me enough information. And we are nowhere near getting the type of information that would allow us to model this. And it's going to be an uncomfortable black box for us. And just to give you an idea how complicated, it's jurisdiction by, you're going to need to give it asset by asset, jurisdiction by jurisdiction and company by company within that jurisdiction. So if you're going to do Shell, it's thousands of pages of stuff that we need to be able to model future taxes. Good luck.
Okay, so basically what you're saying, one way to do, maybe like striking something in between is that the deferred assets and the deferred liabilities should be disclosed separately, and the nature of the breakdown, there should be a breakdown of the nature of these liabilities as a start point, but in the end, it's I think maybe there's a responsibility for the company itself to produce a best estimate and not bother investors with endless jurisdiction-specific information to come up with an own expectation. Maybe the responsibility for providing an estimate of what the future cash outflows are should more be put more at the reporting entity, because I see your problem that if you can provide all the details in the world, but that doesn't make it really analyzable, or that doesn't under what assumptions should the reporting entity
model a single entity. So let's say I always come back to mines because I find it easy to understand. To model a company that has just a consolidated company that has one mine, you would need to know what you need to sort of know is what the tax rates are going to be as they change. So in the earlier years, you have zero tax because you're pulling down the pools, and then you would go to it, and when do you reverse into it? It's also true, by the way, of telecom companies, because in theory they will flip too. If you're dealing with a global consolidated company, you're going to need to give those numbers for significant business units. To Marietta's comment about where is it coming from, and so you might need four. So in one case, you need one line sort of.
But then you still want to do the rework.
The preparers are actually going to. This will be a case of be careful what you wish for, because we'll say don't do deferred tax. We agree it's too complicated. Now let's give us these estimates, and then they're going to go, because those estimates for the poor tax people are going to be hard. But they're in a better position to do it than we are.
I think it's probably a you can ask a preparer to come up with an expected tax rate. Longer term.
The two things that I've asked are, what is the long-term tax rate, and when does it flip? So that piece of information, the estimate of when you chewed up your pools, those are the two things that they should be able to give you.
Okay, thanks. Peter?
I am really reluctant to rely on a figure that comes from the management. I much rather prefer to do my own calculations. And I cannot really see the problems that you are pointing at. I don't think deferred tax liabilities are that complicated in an ordinary business if you don't have revaluation of forest or some property or something. I cannot really see the problems that you are pointing at, actually. But taking a number long term in my valuation based on what the management has given me that I cannot compare to anything, that is to me dangerous.
But from the current disclosures, you cannot know whether the tax liability reverses in 5 years, in 2 years, or in 30 years.
I can look at the tax liability and see roughly how it performs over time.
Roughly.
It's not more important than that compared to everything else. But rely on a percentage that the management is giving me for the coming 5 years when they don't want to give me estimate the coming quarter. No, that I'm not interested in.
Glenn, please.
I'm just wondering if there's a different way through this, which is the essential issue that we're facing. Remember, it's not a little issue, it's a big issue. They are very often the tax take is the biggest single expense item, the single biggest bit that goes out of the revenues.
Supposed
to be. Sorry?
Supposed to be.
Yes. Very often. So to try and encapsulate what is a huge amount and a huge contractual relationship by having a single point is kind of ambitious, I think, especially when you're dealing with large corporates in many jurisdictions. I mean, I take that point. But I think what that's telling you is that large corporations in many jurisdictions are very difficult to value. That's what it's telling you, is that they have a huge standard deviation of outcomes. The variability of the outcomes is massive. It's not the same as a single company in a single jurisdiction. And to try and force the quart into the pint pot here, and to try and make it the same by having a single number for a large multinational, is kind of, in my view, is kind of missing the point, which is that the large multinational actually has a huge amount of uncertainty about what its tax rate is because of these multi-jurisdictional issues, and therefore has a variability that needs to be reflected in the valuation. So I'm wondering if there's a different way through this, which is to say, we know conceptually what the differences are between accounting taxes and the tax comp. We know what they are in the big categories. And so it wouldn't, I mean, I'm just wondering whether a company couldn't just simply disclose for us the main items of what those differences are. So
that's a start point.
But no calculation.
Not necessarily calculation. Just give us the data, right? Give us the data. Say, okay, we've
break
got...
down.
Yes, we've got, you know, we've got X, you know, our tax assets are X and our allowances run at the rate of Y. So we can look at that. We've got revaluations which have a tax impact, RZ. Because I know it's more information, but remember what we're asking for. We ask for huge amounts of information on compensation and directors' pay and all that kind of stuff, which is actually probably a very tiny amount of the revenues. And we ask for very little information on the tax, which is a huge amount of the revenues, the value added that disappears. And so it's not hugely burdensome to ask for more. You don't have to give us the tax details, because of course you can just read the statutes. You know, it's there. Since everyone can just read the statutes and get that. What you don't have are the numbers that you apply to the statutes to get the outcome. So I'm just wondering for the big categories, and obviously it's going to be, it can never be finely detailed, but you could say for the big operating subsidiaries or the big geographies that you disclose under the operating segments, you give us the basic elements of the reconciliation for those, and that's a stab that takes you a little bit further. It's not perfect, it's a little bit further, and it's a bit better than what we have now, maybe, I'm suggesting.
Thank you, Glenn. Last question here. Last remark, please, Maya, before we move on to the next question.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo some of the thoughts of Peter and Glenn, which is that I think, despite all of the intricacies that you correctly described, Robert, there are, overall, if you look at pharma companies over the last 10 years, the tax rates are relatively stable over time. And if there is a term, and then also the net deferred is relatively modest. And whenever you have, you know, really a step change in taxes, it's really due to a single factor, such as, you know, a lot more or less profit coming from a jurisdiction with a totally different tax rate, or a massive change in corporation tax in some country or something like that. So to the extent that the companies just give us some of the key swing factors that are going to determine long-term tax rate, like, you know, mix effects and patent boxes and tax credits, that kind of thing, it would really help our modeling a lot. But they're just very, very reluctant to give out that information because I think, you know, they're just worried that the authorities are going to scrutinize some of their arrangements. So I just wonder, you know, whether, you know, there is some way to write that into a standard that, you know, just some very, very high-level information should be provided that should not be too sensitive, but that should at least tell us, you know, is there any risk that over the next 5 years a 22% tax rate goes to 15% or 30%?
So key drivers will fundamentally change the rates and give you a sense of what
to a certain extent indicate what is permanent and what is... the timing difference, and that goes back to the point that Dan made earlier, because that is often completely missing, and that would be a nice starting point.
Okay, great. We're going to move on to the last question. We have 5 minutes.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I think it seems that most of you prefer more disclosure itself to improving the calculation of the
deferred tax, but assume the calculation of deferred taxes continues, and we are wondering whether the improvement of 2 points make the numbers less artificial. And one is the discounting of the deferred tax balances, and the other one is about the fair value accounting of the liabilities. And in general, elaborate on that.
Okay, we have a very little time, so I don't want to spend too much time, but please look at slide 11 and 12. Slide 11, list of those items basically we think we can improve based on current standards. But the item on slide 12, discounting and evaluation, probably something that we need to study more. Understand what impact and what the right accounting is. Maybe there's no much time, but just briefly, as for discounting, fundamental question is, do you want to see the tax law change? If there's a tax law change and impact, there's a huge impact from tax law change, do you want to see that impact in year one, or do you want to see it over the period? Or if you want to see the impact in year one, do you want the change in to be discounted? That's one question.
I'd like to comment on this one. I think all liabilities are discounted. Hmm. And this is the only one which is not discounted, which is odd. Hmm. I mean, it's a liability. It ought to be discounted. There's time value of money also for cash outflows for tax. I think it's odd that tax liabilities are not discounted.
What's the discount rate?
Sorry?
What's the discount rate?
Well, that's it's the time value of money discount rate.
Yeah, but is it of the operations, or is it what cost of capital are we going to use?
Or is it for the discount, should you apply the discount rate for that industry?
I think let's first find out whether we should discount it. Because the question you ask, which discount rate applies to all the liabilities we have.
Yeah.
So I think we have to break it down then. Do you agree? Is a tax liability so much different that it does not need to be discounted?
No, I did not want to. I'll do this just for
yes, please.
Sorry. I agree with you. Discounting would be nice, but it's going to be tricky to find a discount rate. It should reflect the risk of operations, in my view. But that's a hard number to get.
Okay. And you're speaking in name of Barbara.
Well, no.
just a couple of points too, because what I'm hearing about things like discounting, for example, time and so on, it's actually a completely different model than one we have in here. So what you're saying to what I'm hearing is that some of the information you're looking for is completely different from the information that we're providing in standard. Because in terms of when you say discounting, you do, as well as having a rate, you actually have to know something about the timing.
Yeah.
And our model doesn't do that. It just simply, at a very abstract level, says, here's what a tax balance should look like, here's what an IFRS balance should look like. We'll just take the difference, multiply by the tax rate, and that's it. So it's a different way of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm hearing is that you're interested in trying to understand tax rates, effective tax rates, and you also are interested in the timing thing. And I think related to that, it's one anecdote I give is when IFRS was introduced into New Zealand, I keep going back to New Zealand, the tax department contacted us almost immediately and said we'd like to have a seminar and a series about finding out about it, because that was their window into a company, because they used the difference in the deferred tax liability to try and understand where people were pushing the boundaries on tax, were they being aggressive for accounting a tax and so on. They want to understand how the differences arose, and I think to Peter's point, you're struggling to understand sometimes in this black box where the major differences are. Mm. Now, historically, we have failed abysmally to get a timing type of standard in play because it's so hard to do. FAS 95, I think it was in the US, was deferred and then completely replaced. It never came in because calculating and estimating the timing reversals and what assumptions you make about, well, I'm going to sell that asset, but I'm going to get another one in its place and so on, become inherently complex. So I think it's fascinating. I'm hearing what I thought I would hear, which is really quite comfortable. But it's uncomfortable because it's not what our standards provides you with.
Yeah. Maybe I just want to follow up on this quickly, because let's face it, if timing is really stretched, in the end, the asset needs to be impaired if it's too stretched. So at the moment, investors, the company already needs to make an adjustment, needs to make an assessment on whether how feasible it is to recognize a tax asset. And so that's already, they're obliged to make an assessment on tax assets. So it's just that we want to see more of that granularity of their calculation. And instead of becoming it a binary, like you recognize it or not. And and by making it a time sensitive, the ability to recognize it or not will the difference between that will become less than currently. What you see sometimes now, companies take a fixed charge, and that's an after-tax charge. The next year, you have the another charge for the deferred tax asset because they're not going to be able to recover those losses in time. And that's what you sometimes see, like a $2 billion cost after tax, and then you have another $500 million cost for the tax asset to impair. And let's get rid of that. I mean, let's take the time value, and let's the standard could require time sensitive. Yeah.
Yes, one final question. I understand discounting is important, or time value money is important for analyst work. There's a technical argument in standard setter's world that when asset is fair valued, tax effect is already fair valued, so therefore tax effect is already after discounting.
This is new.
This is very complex. I don't want to dig down more detail, but how many people are bothered by deferred tax and fair valuing? Is it really important?
I see a question, but I first want to make the round off because I still have Peter, please.
No discounting. Period.
Why
it becomes too messy.
Why?
It becomes too messy. I can do it myself, more or less. I can assume that they will use the deferred tax asset if I value a company over the coming 3 years or so. That's sufficient.
You have no reasonable basis to make that assumption.
No, I don't want any discounting of deferred tax assets or liabilities, period.
Can I just add to that straight away?
Yeah.
Because basically, I mean, you know, when you discount pension liabilities or really long-term liabilities, you take long-term capital market rate, which, for example, for German pensions in Q4 14 was 2%. You know, with the tax situation, we're talking about potentially 1, 2, 3 years. So what is the discount rate? I mean, at least in the current environment.
We're making standards for a longer environment.
Of course, the interest rate environment could change, but...
Well, it's finished, it'll change.
Yeah, Robert, please.
Absolutely not discounting, but let me explain why. What we're really caring about is the timing. So once you, to Glenn's sort of comment, you're trying to collapse too many things into one point. What we need to know is the timing and the uncertainty about when these tax flows are coming out. Giving us one number that collapses it, it just isn't helpful. It's just it's a black box on top of an existing black box. So it doesn't help. I know you disagree, but that's tough.
I guess I've got some sympathy with a number of these views. I mean, we've got a black box at the moment, so disaggregation makes sense to most of the guys in the room. It strikes me there are probably some easy wins here. If we look at the segment analysis, at the moment, we normally find that the segment analysis stops before we get to the tax line.
Right.
Now, that strikes me as an easy win there. We can say, let's put the tax in the segment analysis. When they give us a geographic split, can we please have the tax in line with that geographic split? When we get a tax reconciliation that says tax rate, statutory rate, 30%, 35%, effective rate, 10%, difference... foreign tax as a one-line item, that is still a black box. So if there's sort of a big item in the reconciliation, some level of disaggregation to explain what that actually means is helpful.
It does require also for allocation of interest.
Yeah.
And that's
It just strikes me that there's some relatively easy wins here.
And it's just trying to sort of focus on where those easy wins might be gets us away from this complete black box. Now, about this point about discount rates, I think it would be helpful to give us a discount rate and give us the gross number, and then we can work out the timing. Right? So...
You're saying back engineer their assumptions?
But if they give us enough data points, we can start doing that. But if we just say, just give us one number, we do have a problem, yes. But if they're big assumptions that are material to the valuation of the business, I mean, a lot of businesses I look at the moment, and I say, what's the current cash tax rate? If I extrapolate that number into perpetuity, business looks cheap. And then if I put the statutory tax rate in, it looks expensive. And if I say, well, I've got to, if I look at what's the value of a business, it's, for me, the net present value of the future cash flows being generated by that business. So this year's tax rate is interesting, but actually it's the long-term tax rate that's the most interesting.
Yeah.
And so trying to understand the drivers for that long-term tax rate is what I'm most interested in.
Yeah, second
in
reporting is one of the easy tools to...
That's an easy. Just extending all those lines to include the jurisdictions would is a real easy one for the preparers and would be monumental. Well, it would help a lot, and I think that's a very good idea.
Good. We need to wrap up. Peter, I still see your...
Oh, sorry. I'm slow.
I hope you found this course useful.
Thank you very much for your valuable input to us. I think today's discussion was really useful for further work on this hydrogen income tax. We hopefully come back
thank you.
Thank you. Just to accept, in case it helps, I think the idea for this is that we want to try and put out a research paper. It's kind of unlegal. This is not us jumping into a standard setting at the moment. We want to step back and ask these really basic questions that we've been asking you and try to tease this out. So this is a slow burn one for me, because what I'm hearing is you could make a major change and just go back to taxes payable. With different types of disclosures, or you could change to more of a timing issue, difference model and so on. So we've got to be very cautious about this.
Yeah.
But we want to keep the debate sort of going along. This is the very first part of the journey for us.